The following is a special rebroadcast from 2007, our interview with the late Leslie Gore, recorded at the Napa Valley Opera House after her show. She was 60 years old then and had just released the brilliant new record Ever Since, which featured a new version of her hit, You Don't Own Me. Here is that show. Enjoy. The late, great pop singer, American icon, Leslie Gore, on Out in the Bay. Hello, and welcome to Out in the Bay, our weekly show about gay life in San Francisco and beyond. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Our show airs Thursdays at 7 p.m. at KALW 91.7 FM and streams at KALW.org. And then we archive it at OutInTheBay.com for podcasts and on-demand listening. Check it out at OutInTheBay.com. You remember this? It's my party and I cry if I want to. Cry if I want to. Cry if I want to. You would cry too if it happened to you. She was a teenager when she was discovered by a young music producer named Quincy Jones, or Q as she calls him in our interview. He went on to produce many more hits for her, including Judy's Turn to Cry, Sunshine and Lollipops, and a song with feminist overtones before feminism, You Don't Own Me. I'm talking about the legendary pop icon, Leslie Gore. She's in San Francisco at Yoshi's in the Fillmore this Friday, February 13th. Producer Eric Jansen and I caught up with her at the Napa Valley Opera House when she was in the Bay Area 3 years ago, touring with her first album in 30 years, Ever Since. You'll hear some tracks from that record on this show. And now, here's our interview. I was really intrigued by something you said on tonight on stage about Quincy Jones calling you and saying, let's go down to Basin Street and listen to Ella and old Dinah. And I was curious, after you said that, I kept listening and thinking, how did that affect you? What did you learn from those experiences?
You know, I really learned at the hand of the master, and I would go to these shows and not even know that I was what I was picking up. But Q was kind of wondrous in that he would say, listen to how Grady starts this drum solo, or Peggy's opening this show with a slow number for the first time, or the first time the very first time I saw Peggy Lee, Quincy described the show as a Rolls Royce, and that meant it just worked perfectly. You picked up stuff from this guy just through osmosis and being around him and his appreciation. And of course, he was arranging for so many of these wonderful women and producing them. So we would, you know, I'd be able to, like, go backstage and actually meet these people. So it was beyond just going in the studio and having a hit record. It meant a whole lot more to me than just that.
And did he help you with the phrasing? Because I love what you do with the phrasing. The way you handle the song is so masterful. And tonight was such a dream for all of us come true, really. So I was just wondering, was that part of it? Was the phrasing that you... did that start then? Or is that something you're developing further now?
I think the beauty of Quincy, and it's the beauty of any producer, really, is to put an artist in the studio and make them feel so incredibly comfortable that what's ever in them can just pour forth. And Quincy certainly had that ability.
You know him now? I mean, you see him much?
You know, I haven't seen him in a while. I did speak to him a couple of weeks ago, and he's had this huge success with the Color Purple in New York, so we spoke during that time, and he's recouping from two knee operations. so he was he had a lot to talk about.
Do you have any fond memories of the Tammy show, along with, you were on with James Brown and Smokey Robinson and Rolling Stones? Were those good times for you? Did you enjoy that time?
Oh, yeah. It was actually kind of fantastic for me, because it gave me an opportunity to really just stand in the wings and watch some of these people, but close up, not from out front, but really on the side. You know, it's like watching Fats Domino, you know, just play his stuff and watch his courting, and it was amazing. And I watched the Supremes and James Brown, and of course the Jan and Dean were just such terrific guys. It was a great time for me. Interestingly enough, the one thing that I do remember, and this was a little scary, when I came out the very first time, I think we taped two or three or four shows, something like that. The first time we came out to tape, I remember hitting the stage, and I looked over to the musical director, Jack Nitzsche, and his hands came down for the downbeat, and I could see everyone playing. I couldn't hear a thing. It was before we had monitors, and they expected us to be able to hear from but the crowd was screaming so loud that I almost like couldn't hear the key or when I was supposed to start. It was very alarming for me. It was the first time I'd ever been in that position, and I think everyone experienced that, so they tried to find a way to give us some sound on stage.
Sounds like a bad nightmare. I mean, hello, monitors, hello.
Hello.
It seems like you are bridging your past with your present, and it's hard to go back to these old hits, and people want to hear them in a certain way, and you're singing them in a different way. So tell us, what's that like for you to be singing these songs from 40 years ago?
First of all, what we've done with the classic hits is basically we've taken out the horns, we've taken out the string lines, and we've basically concentrated on the rhythm section, the background singers, and the lead vocal. And what it's done, in its interesting way, is you never know with music what's going to happen. But what happened when we pared it down was some of these songs popped out and became kind of more intriguing than they were in their pop 60s thing. Sunshine, just a little bit, Sunshine, Lollipops, and Rainbows slowed down a little with a kind of a more legato piano, has an almost haunting feeling. Everything else basically is up to tempo, like It's My Party and Judy's Turn to Cry. But
on the other hand, You Don't Own Me is also much slower. And I notice you changed. A couple of the lyrics are a little different. I think you've added a line, I want someone who's true, and You Don't Own Me and I Don't Own You. Those are new lines, right?
They are new lines. Somewhere about 10 years ago, I felt as though the song wasn't complete, that it really needed a third verse. And instead of letting the instrumental go by with the strings, I wrote that little four lines because it felt like it was time to reciprocate that message somehow. So it does. It was added some years later. It's like a house with a new wing. You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys. You don't own me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'll never stay. When I go out with you, don't own me. I want somebody who will be true. You don't own me. You don't own me. I don't own you. I don't tell you what to say. I don't tell you what to do. Just
in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman with Eric Jansen. Here's more of our interview.
I noticed that that is the only one of your hits from the 60s that is on the new CD ever since. Why that particular one?
That's the song that I think grows for me more than any other song. It's the song I've closed with most often. Why? Because it's the strongest song in my repertoire. And it's not a song that was just made sense in 1963 or 64. It's a song that's made more and more sense every time I sing it. So that one felt like there was enough room there, because it's such a great song, to do it in a slightly different way and not lose its thrust and its importance and its meaning.
Who wrote the songs on the new album?
Actually, it's a number of people. Blake has written two absolutely fabulous songs for the album. The guitar player who recorded with us, Mike Errico, also wrote two absolutely wonderful songs. Blake and Mike and a couple of others of us wrote one song together, and I wrote a couple of other things. But it is a collaboration in the truest sense, really more with Blake and myself in terms of coming to grips with arrangements and keys and tempos and working together in the studio. And I would say also, you know, when you work with just five people, everything everybody plays at any moment is important. And so it's really truly a collaboration among the six of us on stage. I couldn't do it without them. They couldn't do it without me. So it's been an extraordinary experience. Blake also produced the album, so this is why I give him so much credit and consider him my collaborator.
Here's the title track from Ever Since, Leslie Gore on Out in the Bay.
I dreamt you, I drew you, long before I thought that I might never find you. I chased you, I traced you, and held your picture up into the light. Long to list all the parties I've been to.
tried to forget you, even though I felt somehow someone had sent you here to me. And as if you knew me, we picked up where we left off in another life. The times I've tried to settle out for so much less than this, saved only by the hope in every eyelash. I've waited ever since.
Village Voice calls this album luscious-voiced, organic, smoky, intimate, and personal. And, you know, when you sang Sunshine Lollipops tonight, I was going to say, it doesn't sound like Sunshine Lollipops, but even when you sang Sunshine Lollipops, that was sultrier, more somber. What does that speak to? Why?
I'm going to be 60 years old in a couple of weeks. I think it just speaks to what's age appropriate, how I feel. I take songs that I love and I want to do them different ways, and that feels good to me. It's not at all, I'm not trying to put down my past. I'm trying to embrace it in new and better ways.
Do you ever feel like, because you've had such a long career, that it's almost like different lifetimes as you look back, instead of one lifetime, like there's many different Leslie Gores in some way?
In some ways that's true, but more so now that I have new material. And it's so incredible that, I mean, I depended for so many years on being a part of the oldies niche, and I always felt, well, there's nothing really wrong with it, but it feels like I'm being held back somehow. And this was an opportunity to go, I can love my oldies, but I still have the brain to learn new songs. I want to get up there and I've always wanted to do new songs. If I could do a different show every night, I would, because it's fun for me. So this was an opportunity to kind of put my money where my mouth was.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking, you know, it's kind of like the young girl and now this more sophisticated, bluesy, jazzy, masterful singing. And not that it wasn't great before, but it's a new version of you. It's the current version. That must be what you're feeling.
I am. But, you know, at the same time, when I was 16 or 17, if you came over to my house and we hung out down in the den and I sat down at the piano, you'd hear more material like Out Here on My Own. Oh. And we went so high because I'm sitting at the piano and playing. So that was, you know, I'd sit there and play Misty and all those great old songs and sing ballads. So this is not that far from that. The recordings were much more poppy and meant to be happy and for a different audience.
Were you sort of forced into a genre in a sense then?
Well, I think so. You know, in a way, they were first beginning to discover a teenage market, and clearly, you know, if you were going to play to the teenagers, A good idea was to get a teenager who could actually relate to some of these songs, which I did. I never sang anything I didn't totally believe in at that time, in the same way I wouldn't today. So it all felt, you know, very organic and very right. And but it was the ballads and the sitting at the piano, and that Lena Dinah Ella thing has been a part of my life and my DNA since I can remember.
I don't know if it's if you'll talk about this, but obviously we've done a little homework here, and I wanted to ask you about, because I miss her, Bella Abzug, who was such a pioneer and such a model for me back in the 70s, and I know she was a mentor to you. And can you talk about her influence on you? Because nobody talks about her anymore.
Yes, we do. There's been an institute that's just been started at Hunter. It's called Ballet, the Bella Abzug Leadership Institute. Now, what could be better than having Bella's thoughts and Bella's expertise at speaking and knowing? She was so incredible when it came to strategy and working with people. This was an incredible woman. And I also have to say, in a funny way, Bella helped me kind of come out publicly. Mm-hmm. Because she encouraged me to be myself. She encouraged me to speak on behalf of women. And she encouraged me to feel comfortable in my skin. And for that, I thank her virtually every day.
There's a line that grabbed me in one of your songs, Someday, and it's the music pretty much stops behind you, and you say, I'm not going to get the line right. I am myself. I know myself. Or can you tell me?
I know myself, and I am not afraid. From You Don't Know Me to Out Here on My Own to Someday, it's the same message. It's survival. It's look for the glass half full, not half empty. Challenge yourself on every level, every day, all the time. And, you know, love the ones that you're supposed to love. And, you know, and keep your world small, but do it well.
What about when you had that period of acting and you were on Batman? What was that? Was that period of time for you easy? Hard? Were you comfortable in your own skin then?
Yeah, I was actually. I did a lot of appearances like that. Usually I played myself. Batman was actually very comfortable for me because my cousin, he was kind of an uncle through business, a wonderful man. Howie Horowitz was the producer of the show, and he called me up and invited me to be on the show with Julia Newmar, and they kind of created the part for me, Pink Pussycat. On Batman.
Now, could you have imagined with your new record that you would have gotten it on television like it's been? They're buying songs for CSI Miami, for the L Word on Showtime. You've got, your music is like getting out there besides just the record itself. People are buying your records for motion pictures.
Well, you know, it's kind of incredible because I grew up in the world of corporate records. Mercury Records was my first recording label. And after a while, you know, I mean, the industry has just gotten younger and younger and younger and younger. I mean, I don't, if Frank Sinatra were around today, they'd probably kick him out the door. So there's really no respect for the other artists. And when it came time to figuring out how to go and what to do, when Blake came to me with the idea of doing an album with an independent label, I thought carefully about it, but I thought it was really a good idea. And it's interesting because it kind of harkens back to our 60s principles, where we know kind of everybody who signs on. You sell 20 records at a gig, that's great. You sell 20 more the next day on the net, and you know everyone who is involved, and it's kind of nice.
Yeah, the web must be a positive influence for the sales of your music.
It is. It's great. Been great.
Can you believe we live this long to see things like the web and even the L Word and some of the things that we're experiencing these days? Can I ask you, do you believe in gay marriage? Do you care about any of that?
I care about everything. That happens not to be an issue that I think is as important as a few other things. Don't misunderstand me. I think if we can get legislation passed for gay marriage, that that is a good thing. Do I personally wish to get married? It's not my choice, so it's on a back burner as far as I'm concerned. But equality is really important for me.
So is it still your party?
You bet your ass.
And are you going to cry if you wanna?
Never again.
Listening to a special rebroadcast of our 2007 interview with the legendary pop icon, the late, great Leslie Gore. She died this past Monday, February 16th, in New York City at the age of 68. We couldn't believe she agreed to be on our gay radio show back then, and that she was even gay, I guess. But she did, somewhat reluctantly in the beginning moments, and then it all flowed smoothly and we got our tape, as we say in radio. It was an honor to talk to her and listen to the record she put out that year ever since. Out in the Bay is a seriously nonprofit enterprise consisting of Eric Jansen and I putting our 50 plus years of radio experience to work every week because we care and we know we're serving the community. And not just the LGBT community either. This is a mainstream gay radio show for everyone. It's our 10th year, and we're going to celebrate soon with the details on the air, on our website, outinthebay.org, and on our Facebook page and Twitter feed. Find us, like us, retweet us, follow us, and most important of all, pay us. We don't make our living doing this show, but it does feel good to pay the bills and pay ourselves something once in a while. If you're a corporate sponsor or work for a company that might like the co-branding with us, connect us. Write us at eric@outinthebay.org or marilyn@outinthebay.org. We'd also love for you to sign up for our occasional email updates. Just go to outinthebay.org and hit subscribe at the top of the page. That's after you hit donate and be like Brad Payton and Richard Merck of Portola Valley, California, or Richard and Phoebe of Portland, Oregon. They contributed in the hopes that you, too, will do the same, so you can get your name on the air. Okay, I hope you enjoyed this special rebroadcast of our 2007 interview with the late, great Leslie Gore. Thanks to KALW. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining me.